Well, how do you think you did on the examination? No one answered F, hopefully. What do you think your class mean was?
73?
That would be nice. That would be nice. Class mean was 67. Which is about where it is, usually. I'll hand those back today. If you don't like the fact that the class mean is 67, you'll probably like less the fact that this is usually the highest score of the five tests. It's the easiest of the five tests for most people. Doesn't have to be. It depends on you, but that's usually true as an average. Okay, so it's expect them to go down. I hope they don't, but they always do. 2 and 3. 3 is usually the bottom. And then it goes up, but really not because it gets easier. I think it's mostly because by the time you get to 3, people that have no chance of passing leave, and then the mean goes up because of that. But anyway, I will put the test up. So I'll give you your Scantrons, and I'll put the test up so you can make sure, for one thing, that the Scantron machine didn't make any mistakes. So look at them, make sure they're properly marked. Also make sure, I haven't entered them into Canvas yet, but I will. That's a manual process, me typing it in. So also make sure that I type it in correctly, that you're given the same score that you are supposed to have according to the Scantron form. But also, who can remind us of what you promised when you signed the rules consent form? Regarding the test.
Oh, no.
We can discuss it.
Okay.
You just can't record it in any way. And what happens if you do? Whether you write down the questions or take pictures or whatever, what happens?
Fail the class.
Immediate failure of the course. That hopefully is enough disincentive. So feel free to look at it, discuss it with me. Try to find some error that I made in it. But that has happened. It's just rare. Okay, now for today's stuff, we are doing a little bit of experimentation involving tests for organic macromolecules. A macromolecule, as the name implies, is a big molecule. Of course, all molecules from our point of view are tiny, but some molecules are a lot bigger than other molecules. A water molecule is not a macromolecule. It's a pretty tiny molecule. And we'll be talking, once we resume the lectures in Unit 2, we'll be talking a lot more about biological macromolecules. There's 4 major categories: polypeptides, polysaccharides, nucleic acids, and lipids. We'll be talking about all those 4 in detail upstairs. But today, what we focus on is testing for some of these. And what I mean by testing is it's often the case in science that you have, for whatever reason, a solution that you don't really know the contents of. And it's useful to know the contents of solutions so you can perform various tests to see whether or not a specific thing is part of that solution. That's the whole idea of the test you're performing today. We're not doing a big battery of tests. There's only 3 tests that we're focusing on. And you should already know that from doing the pre-lab quiz last night. What's the Benedict's test? What is that test for? That tests for monosaccharides, which are simple sugars. Simple meaning they are just one subunit big. There are complex sugars, polysaccharides that are much bigger because you take a bunch of monosaccharides and hook them together to build those polysaccharides. Benedict's test doesn't test for those. It tests for monosaccharides. What about the Bayuret test? Proteins. Right. And then the only other one we're doing is the IKI test, which tests for starches. Starches are polysaccharides. So both the IKI and the Benedict's test test for carbohydrates or sugars, but the sizes differ. IKI will be a positive result if there is starch there, which is a big polysaccharide. IKI, by the way, is not really an acronym. It is a chemical formula. It stands for iodine potassium iodide. And it's, of course, potassium has K as a symbol. Say that kind of facetiously, but it does make sense because another name for potassium is kalium. That's where the K comes from. But anyway, iodine potassium iodide is the stuff that's in the IKI solution, the test solution that you use to test for starch. Now, two of these tests are really straightforward, and so I'm just going to let you follow the instructions to do those without me saying much more about them, more than I already did. And those are the Bayuret test for protein and the IKI test for starch. Those are pretty easy to deal with. The other one, though, the Benedict's test, I want to explain a little bit more because I want to describe what's happening, not only for the sake of explaining today's stuff, but because we're going to talk much more about this eventually, especially in Unit 3. And that's because this involved, the Benedict's test works because of what is called redox, which is a portmanteau, a word that's two words combined into one. It's redox is really short for reduction oxidation. And that's what we're going to discuss much, much more about upstairs eventually when we get there. I just want you to be introduced to it today. And it's confusing. Well, before I even say that, notice that I wrote reduction slash oxidation. That's where the redox word comes from. But it's a good word to remind you of the fact that if this is happening, not just one, but both of these processes that it's named for are happening. In other words, it's both or neither. It's not just reduction or just oxidation. It's both if it's happening. And that's because that will make sense when we talk about what the definition is. And the definition is what is linguistically confusing at first. Because we are accustomed to thinking of reduction as being the loss of something, like weight reduction, right? You're losing mass, you're exerting less weight. Well, in chemistry, reduction is the gain of an electron or more. All right? So not the loss, it's the gain of an electron. If something gets reduced, it gains an electron. So it seems linguistically backward, but it's not really when you think about what an electron is, right? It's an electron is a negatively charged particle. So if I give you an extra electron, what is happening to your charge numerically? It's going down, right? It's becoming more negative because I'm giving you negativity. It's like adding a negative number to something, right? You're reducing the value. So make sense of it that way, but keep track of it in your mind however it's necessary for you personally. The two processes are opposite, though. So oxidation is just the opposite of reduction. It is the loss of an electron. All right? And this is why it should make sense now that you can't have reduction without also having oxidation. Because the electron involved doesn't just pop into existence and it doesn't just cease to exist. It's there the whole time. Which means nothing can receive an electron without it coming from something that's losing the electron, and vice versa. In other words, only if something is oxidized will something be reduced. Only if something's being reduced will something be oxidized. They go hand in hand always. It's what? As in the example that we discussed for ionic bonds, right? But as we'll talk more about upstairs, it doesn't always involve ionization. That's a clear-cut example, though, of oxidation reduction. Okay, so keep in mind that reduction is the gain, oxidation is the loss of an electron. Okay, now, the molecular explanation of how Benedict's solution works is on page 48, if you want to look at that while I'm speaking. Benedict's solution, as it's called, which is the blue stuff back here, and before I forget to tell you, when you use Benedict's solution, you're not pouring it from the bottle. You're using this thing, which is called a repipetter. Don't touch this thing that's been locked on 2 milliliters. That's already set. Okay? To use this thing, it's a pump, but instead of pushing on it, you pull it up. First, you just have your empty tube on the spout so that you'll receive it instead of just spilling it. So put it under there, pull this thing up until it stops, and then just let go. Or if you have to, you can slightly push it down if it doesn't just fall. But since it's set to 2, when you pull it up all the way and push it down all the way, it will deliver exactly 2 milliliters into your test tube. Okay, but anyway, notice that it's blue. It's blue. What gives it the blue appearance is that Benedict's solution is an aqueous solution, so it's mostly water, but the solute in there is copper. Specifically, one of multiple types of copper ions. Now, this first group and the second group, each of these metals forms ions only one way. Sodium can only form an ion one way, by losing one electron. Magnesium has to lose 2. There's only one possibility. So there's not multiple versions of ions for those first two groups. But some of the metals that are in this area have multiple possibilities. And notice that copper is in there, right here. These so-called transition elements, or transition metals, can form multiple different versions of ions. And that includes copper. Well, the copper ion version that is in Benedict's solution before you use it, the blue stuff, is specifically copper 2, which you symbolically write as Cu with a 2 plus superscript, meaning that it has a positive 2 charge. Now, how does it have a positive 2 charge? How does it come to have that positive 2 charge? By losing 2 electrons, right? It's copper atom first. It's no charge because it has the same number of electrons as protons. But by losing 2 electrons, it becomes positive 2 charge. And when you have trillions of those in a little bit of water, it's what makes it look blue to us. Okay. Now, the test is for monosaccharides. And not a specific monosaccharide, any monosaccharide. So glucose is an example. It's one that you built with the molecular modeling kits. But it can be any of several other. There's all kinds of monosaccharides. So it could be fructose, for instance, all kinds of them. As long as they're monosaccharides, they could work. But I have to tell you just a little bit of something I haven't said yet because we haven't gotten to the chapter yet. A monosaccharide can exist in either of two forms. You built what's called the linear form because the carbon skeleton was a line, zigzag, but It had two ends. It's also possible to bring those ends together, or bring two parts of the skeleton together to make a ring. So that doesn't change the monosaccharide. For instance, glucose is glucose when it's in the linear form, but it's also glucose when it forms a ring. So there's a linear version and a ringed version for monosaccharides. Benedict's solution for a positive test requires not only that a monosaccharide be present, but that it be in the linear form. Another thing, and I'll repeat this upstairs once we get to it, but it's pertinent to this, is that if you're building a polysaccharide by hooking together a bunch of monosaccharides, the monosaccharides cannot be in linear form. To hook them together, they have to be in the ringed form. That's the only way they'll chemically bond together. All right? So when you have a polysaccharide, technically you have a bunch of monosaccharides, but they're all in the ringed form and hooked together. The reason that matters is that in the ringed form, which you can see in the middle of page 48, that middle figure is glucose going from linear gradually to ringed form. And notice that only in the linear form does it have the C double bond O, which is what functional group? Carbonyl. In order to complete the ring, and just think about this in common sense terms, if you're going to complete a ring with a ball and stick model that already is full in the linear form as far as holes are concerned, the only way you're going to be able to do that is if you empty some holes so that you can make more bond, make an additional bond, right? Well, that hole that you have to empty is one of the springs of the double bond in the carbonyl group. So notice the ringed form on the right of that figure. There is no carbonyl. That's still glucose, but it's a different version of it. It is not, though, a carbonyl-containing compound. Okay? Now, the reason that's important for the test is that the Benedict's test relies on a visual change, something that's evident to your eyes, which is why it starts as blue, which is obvious that that's blue to people, but it changes color. And it changes color if monosaccharides are there, because monosaccharides are called reducing sugars. Okay? Now, there's some little bit more confusing terminology I need to talk about in terms of redox. The thing that is being reduced, which is the thing that is gaining the electron, right? That thing, it can also be called the oxidizing agent. And that's because by being reduced itself, by receiving that electron, it's causing something else to be oxidized, stripped of that electron, so that it can receive it. All right? So don't be confused by that. Make sense of it in your mind. Conversely, the thing that is being oxidized, the thing that's losing the electron, can be called the reducing agent. It doesn't become reduced itself, it becomes oxidized, but it causes something else to be reduced. That's why it's the reducing agent. Is all of that linguistically clear? Well, monosaccharides are called reducing sugars because they are reducing agents, which means what happens to them? What happens to reducing agents in general? They become oxidized. Right. In other words, they lose an electron. And the reason that they're so easily able to lose an electron is because the electrons that make up that double bond of the carbonyl can easily be lost. Okay, they're vulnerable to being oxidized because of that. And in Benedict's solution, when you put the monosaccharide in linear form in there, an electron from that carbonyl group, an electron being shared by carbon and oxygen at the moment in the sugar, leaves the sugar and gets stuck onto a copper 2 ion that's part of the solution. What happens when you add an electron to copper 2? What, first of all, what is that process? What process is happening to copper in that case? Reduction. It's being reduced. And the thing doing that is the sugar. That's why it's called a reducing sugar. It's reducing something else, the copper. But what does that turn copper 2 into? Copper 1. Cu with a 1 plus subscript, superscript. Right? Because now it has one more electron than it had before. So it only has one positive charge, right? It was copper 2 to begin with, meaning it had two fewer electrons than it had protons. Now it has the same number of protons, but it has one more electron, so it has one fewer electron than protons, which makes it only one positive. And notice what happened to it numerically. It went from positive 2 to positive 1. That's reduction numerically, because it gained the electron. And the reason that's important for the test is because that changes what the solution looks like to us. So that's the visual cue to us that there is a positive result. All right? If a huge fraction or all of the trillions of copper ions that are in the solution become reduced, then it not only will no longer be blue, it will be fully brick red. Kind of a muddy red color. It's real obvious. But obviously, if there are trillions of copper ions, it's possible for only some of them to be reduced into copper 1 ions. And that's important for the test because these are qualitative tests as opposed to quantitative. So they tell you whether or not something is present, but they don't tell you numerically how much is present. Still, though, even though they're qualitative, by how much color change there is, you have a comparative idea of how much monosaccharide is there. Because it can turn anything in between blue and brick red. It can go to green and to yellow, just depending on how much monosaccharide is present. So you can't put a number to it, but you can compare one that's yellow to one that's brick red and say this brick red one has even more monosaccharides than this yellow one does. All right? So that's how the test works based on these definitions. That's just Benedict's. But for all of three of these tests, they operate based on something that's obvious change to your eyes. They're useful, though, only if you have a good idea of what a true negative looks like and what a true positive looks like. So you have to do a little bit of preliminary work today before you actually use these tests to try to figure out the contents of these bottles that are labeled as unknown bottles. Really, they're bottles of solution of undetermined solutes, but unknown bottles is how they're labeled. These are solutions that you don't know what's in them, but you can't jump right to those because you have to employ these tests with some knowledge of what the good results look like. That's why you have your known solutions in the white basket in front of you. Those are all labeled with what they are. So for each of these three tests, you need to pick out an appropriate substance that will give you a definite negative and a definite positive. You need to run it twice. So, for instance, for Benedict's solution, for a good negative, you would choose something that you know has no monosaccharides in it. Water does not. That's true. Okay? And so, by looking at that, how it looks for a true negative, then you can use that information later. And then choose something that you know has monosaccharides in it so you can get a good positive. And the same thing for the Bayerette test and for the IKI test. Once you know what the good... Oh, and then for each one, also do just any others known that you have. Just pick another one and see what it looks like. It could be in between the positive and the negative, for instance. But just pick a third one to do, just as a practice run for all three tests. All right, so that's 9 tests that you do before you can get to the point of doing the unknowns. Okay, when you're ready to do the unknowns, notice that they are labeled A, B, C, and D. Or no, just A, B, and C. There's A, B, and C, but there are 4 A's, A1 through A4, 4 B's and 4 C's. Every bottle is different. So pick anyone you want, but pick one of the A's, one of the B's, one of the C's, each group, and you can work as a table and discuss it with, you know, with each other. That's really important, as always. But anyway, write down the specific A that you have. Don't just write down A, the specific A, A2 or whatever, the specific B and the specific C. The idea here is to try to figure out what is in each one of these by running all three tests on each of the three unknowns. So you're going to do an IKI, a Bayerette, and a Benedix for whichever A you choose. You're going to run all three tests on the B. You're going to run all three tests on the C. So after you've done your 9 preliminary tests, you're going to have to do 9 tests for the unknown as well. Now, you're not entirely in the dark about what's in these. There are choices listed in a table in the manual. It gives you possible ingredients. And so the idea here is to use deduction, reasoning, to figure out what it could be in each of your unknowns based on whether it's positive or negative for each of the three tests. Does that all make sense? Once you have your guesses or your ideas of what is in each of your three unknowns, and I don't have those memorized, so just come up to me with your guesses at the end and I'll look at the key on the other side of the door and tell you whether you're right. Everything clear? Now, you're dealing with chemicals, nothing that's very likely to kill you. Some of it is slow-acting poison. You'll probably be dead within 100 years. No, but seriously, it's not truly dangerous stuff, but you should be wearing gloves and goggles while you're doing this today. Okay? Let me know if you need help. I'm going to enter the grades.